It's February.
Good evening, everyone. Or afternoon, rather. If you all take a seat, we can begin our meeting. Thank you very much. And welcome to a special meeting with the City Council today, Wednesday, July the 21st, of the year 2010. The time now is 5:08. And the clerk, would you read the opening statement, please?
Bill Grove City Council welcomes, appreciates, and encourages participation in the City Council meeting. The City Council requests that you limit your presentation to 3 minutes per person so that all present will have time to participate. City Council reserves the right to reasonably limit the total time for public comment on any particular notice agenda item as it may deem necessary. If you wish to address the council during the meeting, please complete a speaker card and give it to myself, interim city clerk, prior to consideration of the agenda item.
Thank you. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Hume.
Here.
Councilmember Davis is absent. Councilmember Cooper is absent. Vice Mayor Detrick is absent. Mayor Sherman.
Here. Please join us at the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
There is no closed session. And as you can see, we do not have a quorum, which was not expected. As was expected, I should say. So, because we do not have a quorum, we cannot continue a special meeting. But what we can do, there is a letter that the city manager needs to read at this point in time.
I've been asked to read a joint statement by Vice Mayor Steve Detrick, Councilmember Jim Cooper, and Councilmember Gary Davis. The residents of our great city have high expectations of their city council. One of these expectations is that we work together as a council on their behalf to move the city of Elk Grove forward. This is particularly true when it comes to protecting our residents against sex offenders. We must have a united front against these criminals in keeping the community safe. As you can imagine, we were surprised when we received notice last night that Mayor Sherman had called a special meeting of the city council for consideration of a matter that is already on the agenda next week. Furthermore, the meeting is being held at 5 o'clock while most residents are just leaving work. Calling last-minute special meetings at times inconvenient to the public is a deceitful behavior of the past. It must not be repeated. Had the mayor consulted with the rest of the city council, as every mayor has done the past 10 years, she would have known we are out of town or unavailable. In fact, each of us asked her to reschedule this meeting, and she has refused. This act not only impedes our ability to work together as a council, but oversteps the bounds of the office of the mayor, and frankly does a major disservice to the public we are sworn to represent. Therefore, in conjunction with the Brown Act and Elk Grove City policy, we are calling a special meeting of the Elk Grove City Council for Wednesday, July 28, 2010 at 6 o'clock. The purpose of the special city council meeting is to discuss the role of the mayor and also to consider the appointment of the mayor for 2010. End of message.
Thank you. I can just end that with a text message that I received from Councilmember Davis. And he said, asked me about if the meeting was to move forward. And I do have copies of that. It's on record. That it was the meeting going to be held. And I responded, yes, there will be a meeting. He then responded with, then you need to know a movement is afoot to remove you as mayor if you do not. So, having said that, I don't believe in threats, and I'm doing what I need to do, and I'm doing it in the best interest of the city of Elk Grove. This was an urgent matter that was brought before us last Wednesday, and a lot of things were brought forward that needed to be discussed. There's been emails, there's been press releases, there's been phone calls, there's been side meetings, and the reason I called this meeting was to gather everyone together, hopefully, so we could all share the information. So when the two council members that have elected to be the two people that are going to be meeting with the community, the citizens tomorrow, they would have added information, but they are not here. As you heard from the letter, they elected not to be here. They personally told me that it was not well, they stated that it wasn't necessary to be here, it wasn't urgent. So, having said that, I will close this special council meeting and let you know that we are here this evening. I have our city attorney and our chief and our city manager who has additional information, and we can now listen, and if you wish to come up and speak, that would be great if you want to share more information. There are things that we all don't know because I have not been privy to the meetings that have been being held, so I felt necessary that five councilmen, all of us, should be involved in selecting this ad hoc committee that we had given staff to, excuse me, to close the meeting, Jason. Okay. At our last council meeting, we had directed staff to gather information, bring it back in, but then talk about an ad hoc committee. That has not is not happening. We have the two council members that have already basically elected themselves to be the ad hoc committee, and so we really don't know what's been going on. I can speak personally for myself. I do not know what has been going on between the meetings that we've held. At this point in time, I would entertain people that would like to come up and speak. If you would like to speak now, or would you like to wait to hear the information that's going to be shared by our staff? You would like to speak?
I think
they
can speak.
Councilmember
Hume? Well, no, I don't want to speak. I just want clarification that since we've closed the special meeting, we're now just, this is more of an open forum type format we're making eliminate out of women's.
That's correct. This will just be for your information. If you want to make a report back to your fellow council members on the 28th when this item comes back before you, you can do so.
So, the folks that want to speak, do you want to speak now, or would you like to wait? It's your pleasure. It's just an open forum right now, so whatever you'd like to do.
Well, I simply have a question.
All right, sir.
My name's Paul Lindsay.
I'll wait.
I'm happy to wait till after you spoke.
Thank you. Hi.
I'm
Dallas Broussard. I also want to say before we get started, I only want to get this out before anyone else talks. We just want to resolve the issue. Whatever is going on between the rest of the council and you folks, I hope, I pray, that it doesn't interfere with what our goal is. And our goal is to make this problem go away. So, I hope all that gets fixed, but we still want to make sure that the water doesn't get muddy and we can still move forward. So that's what we're afraid of this now.
No, don't be, because that is, you know, the reason this meeting was so we can all share, you know, the information at the same time and then digest it and have ready for Wednesday. It didn't come to pass, so I apologize for that. I tried to get it going, but no, it will not be set aside.
Okay,
I
just want to be on task.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
I'll reserve comments for later, but I do have a question.
Yes, sir.
And I'll address it to the city attorney. The letter that you read tonight from the three city council members.
City manager read.
Mm-hmm. Seems to me to be prima facie evidence of a Brown Act violation. And I want to know what the opinion is of that. Obviously, they got together in some way, whether it be phone, email, or actually in person, and discussed this and came to a decision to do this without having public involvement. And since it was three members, it seems to me it is a Brown Act violation. So if you care to address that, I'd be more than happy to hear what you have to say.
Within the Brown Act, under 54956 of the Government Code, the law allows three council members to ask for a majority of the legislative body, which in the case of the city of Elk Grove would be three council members, to ask for a special meeting. So I think in some ways the Brown Act invites people to discuss, council members to discuss amongst themselves, even in the absence of a noticed agendized meeting, the issue of whether there should even be a special meeting. I'm not sure at this point whether there was a Brown Act violation or not, in light of the fact that the Brown Act in some ways invites councils to do exactly what Vice Mayor Dector and Councilmember Davis and people have done with this letter. So I'm not sure that's the answer, but that's the best I can give you.
And just to address Ms. Kelsey's comment, also Ms. Broussard's comment, and this is me speaking as an individual, you know, I'm really pretty sick and tired of intercouncil politics. I think it's a joke, and I think it makes us look like a joke, and it makes our city look like a joke, and we get caught up in these little bickering sessions. It's not healthy for anyone. And I'm here, I have other things I should be doing, I have somewhere I need to be in a little while. I'm here because this is a very important issue. And I think to wash our hands of it and say that the state has us handcuffed doesn't get the job done as far as for what I think people put their faith in us to do. And so when this special meeting was called, I decided I would be here, if for nothing else, than to start honing towards what are we trying to accomplish, how are we going to get there, what provisions are within the law, and what kind of help do we need to bring to the table. And so that's, you know, really what I'd like to speak about and hear about tonight is how do we take this issue that I think all of us makes our stomachs turn and address it and not throw a bunch of legislation at it, throw a bunch of band-aids at it. You know, I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but I'm here to try and learn more about it. And so this idea that we're just going to get into this little bickering of who did what, who said what, and who's more, you know, put yourselves aside for a minute and just represent the people who are put the faith in.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yes,
ma'am. I'm Carrie Wilmot. I'm the one who brought this issue to the table last week. I don't know what everybody else's intention is and why you're here, but I know why I'm here, and it's for my 7-year-old daughter, my 18-month-old daughter, my 3-year-old best friend's son, my 8-year-old son. I am here for them. I don't care about what goes on between you guys. I don't care what goes on here. I am here to protect my children and the children that I love. And what I want to say is, I don't care how it gets done. I know you have to abide by a law. You're going by what the law says. But I need your help. My kids need your help. The law says that I am liable and negligent if I put my children in harm. The county and the city and the state of California are putting my children in harm's way. And I can't protect them other than coming to you, other than coming to Sacramento County, other than coming to the state of California and the federal government. If I have to, I will take it that far because the laws have to change. A juvenile sex offender is no different from an adult sex offender other than their age. That is it. They commit adult crimes against children. Maybe adults, I don't know. But this is ridiculous, and I want it to go away. I want the laws changed. So I hope to God that everyone here wants to help get together and make this happen. Since the last meeting that we had, I got a phone call for an interview to do with the Department of Social Services licensing agency department, and found out some very interesting violations that have been going on over there. Housing offenders with offendees is totally against the law, and they have been doing that. Matthias Home has been violating the law as it stands right now, even though they haven't been violating a proposed law, which we would prefer. Why their license hasn't been pulled, I don't know. But someone needs to investigate. The 10-year-old or the person who we referenced in the court case before, which was placed in that home, from 2004 to 2007. There were people sent over to that house to find whether there were violations in that home, and during that time, he was having sexual relations with 10 other residents of that home. It's disgusting, and something has got to be done. And I hope and pray that you guys help, because if it doesn't happen here, I will take it somewhere else. Thank you.
Karen, just a sec. Go ahead, Pat, and then I want to...
Yeah, before you leave the podium, just so that we can kind of, you say that this has to change. What is this? Do you want that particular house closed down? Do you want to change the law that addresses the allowance of these group homes? And part of one of the things that I know staff has been struggling with, one is, what is the end result? Do we want to have better controls on these individuals? Do we want to have better controls on the whole houses? And so part of the slippery slope is that all group homes are kind of lumped in together. So you could have an Alzheimer's group home, you could have a halfway house or a recovering addicts home, you could have one of these types of homes. They're all considered more or less the same, they're governed the same way. So.
Right. And I understand that. There does need to be separation. You know, they have levels of homes that are ranging from 1 to 15. The house that is in our neighborhood is a 12. I mean...
Meaning there are 12 people living there?
No, meaning it's a level 12. It's in severity of what's there.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. I don't have a problem with homes to help people. I have a... She passed away, but my aunt had Down syndrome. I fully believe that there are homes out there to help people. The help that these kids need isn't getting done over there. The people they have working there make $10 an hour. They have no education. They're paid to babysit. And they're not doing a good job of it because they're in and out, having visitors, allowing the kids to escape so that we have to escort them home, verbally assaulting the neighborhood's neighbors. I mean, these are the things that, going back to what you originally asked me, what I want to see, my goal, yes, I want that home gone, but my goal, absolutely, is to change the law so that it all reflects the same as adults. Right now, I don't believe that there is a law, because if it was, they wouldn't be there. If you're registered sex offender, you can't be within 2,000 feet of a school or a park as an adult. If it does apply to juveniles, which I don't believe it does, they'd be in violation, because there's a park right down the street, there's a senior center right down the street, and there's a school, an elementary school and a junior high school down the street. So, what's the difference? Why are you applying the law for an adult and not applying the law to a juvenile just because of their age? Because I'll tell you what, the boy who performed the lewd act that night, he was over 200 pounds and over 6 feet tall, and he could have passed as an adult. So, I hope that answered your question.
Carrie, if I may, just one step further. As you heard the other night, we do have another home that we tried to get rid of that closed down in 06, I believe it was, and it was, you know, taken to the legislature by our Senator Rico Aller, and it really hit a stone wall. It went nowhere. We went to hearings, you know, spoke and all that kind of stuff, and it didn't work. What I hope to accomplish starting this evening is to get as many citizens involved so that we can go down in mass, because this can be changed.
Right.
There is no way in my mind that says that it can't happen. It can. We see it happen all the time when people rally together, and I mean together as one, and go and present the case. And I applaud you for bringing this to our attention. You know, we live in neighborhoods that maybe we don't have a home there, but I happen to have those three houses that are in my district.
Right.
You know, there's two, the one with your place, and I think, what, two, three blocks away from your street is another one.
Right.
So if we can continue with the dialogue tonight, that would be very helpful. Then I know we have the news reporter here. He'll be reporting. We'll have a report back to our fellow councilman, you know, next Wednesday. And the more information we gather tonight, I think it's going to be, absolutely imperative that we get this group and get this group moving and moving to close it down. And I'm like you, it's okay to, you know, bring out the supervisors and have one-on-one supervision. I don't want that. I want them out of there. I want it gone. I want the house gone. I want it shut down and gone.
And, we live in America. We live in a great country. I love this state. I love this community. I love living here. The great part about being here is that we can all make a change, and that's really what I want to do. I really want to make a safe environment for my children. And that's it.
Well, Carrie, we can make it happen. We as a whole state, we can make it happen.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Madam Mayor, while we're waiting
yes.
for the next speaker, I'm sorry. The next speaker's here, never mind.
I'm Connie, I'm the founder of Belleville Community Connection. I'm here on behalf of Senator Torb, who's our media spokesperson. This is about raising awareness. This is what we do in Elk Grove. And if we have to pass legislation, that's what we do. We did it with the street raising ordinances. Pat, you wrote the education component to that street raising ordinance, as I recall. It was adopted statewide. It went to our police department. Did an education in the school. Jan Sully adopted the program to educate regionally about the dangers of street racing, because we vowed here in Elk Grove not one mother is going to bury her child due to street racing. This is what we do in Elk Grove. We did it with the social host ordinance. We did it with the gang prevention orders. No, it wasn't passed, but you saw for yourself in the presentation that Sergeant Albright did. We raised awareness about gang prevention in our city. It started, they had a whole forum at the Board of Suits about that, because it started here in Elk Grove. Now, the ordinance that we came forward with was modeled after San Diego. It was modeled after National City, giving them full credit. National City took the lead on this. They gave it to San Diego, they gave it to El Monte, they gave it to Elk Grove. That's what it's about. And if you saw Carrie and her husband and Dallas and his beautiful granddaughter on Channel 13 last night, what they did last night and how those anchors responded, that's the message that we're sending home from Elk Grove. Now, this fighting has got to stop. I am telling you, I am sick of it for 10 years. These 3:30 meetings that we have, we were promised that we would never have these meetings again. This is counterproductive to what we were doing. There is nothing more important in this city than our children. And if all of us can't stand together for the safety of our children, we all need help. Because they matter more than petty politics, they matter more than personal vendettas, they matter more than anything else. And if you're not willing to do that and put it aside, then we need to replace all five of you, because I am sick of it. And I know there's a lot of other citizens that feel the same way I do. Our children come first, no matter what.
Thank you. We'll be listening to the people that want to... We'll be listening to the people that continue to hear from people that want to solve the problem.
Frank Mayer. I am speaking tonight as a member of that community. Probably just throw a rock four blocks over at this home. Maybe two blocks around. My son has a home and four or five homes, four or five daughters. Have their five grandchildren. They visit both of the residences on a frequent basis. I would like to suggest before I get into some other comments that I think the carriage seems to be quite a remarkable. I'd also like to say that I'm not sure I have a mix of emotions tonight in regards to the circumstance, because I believe wholeheartedly that she is right, the primary focus that we should have. But I'm not sure if I'm angry, disappointed, what I, how I choose to describe it. I feel a little out of my element at the moment. But we'll go with disappointment in order to keep the language somewhat civil. Because I do care what's going to happen. What I care about is if we continue down this path of having activist groups writing ordinances without the involvement of the community. I live just down the street. Where's this ordinance? Has it been, has it gone to the city attorney for scrutiny at this point in time? Why isn't that a public document if it's a proposed, if you're a transparent public organization? Why doesn't the public get to scrutinize that? I'd like to know that. I'm concerned about the fact of not calling a public meeting related to these concerns. Or a neighborhood meeting. No flyer on my door. No, not on my subject door. This should not be a narrow focus for either political gain, attention. And that's got to stop. So my last emotion I'll leave with after I'm going to have a question or an observation of my experience as a public official when it comes to Brown. But I plead with all councilmen. I know y'all. We've socialized together. In the fundraisers that we attend, in the progress we try to move forward with this community, we all have difference, and we get cranky with each other, and we get angry with each other. But we can do that and still move forward, because you don't have to hold animosities, and you don't have to have petty politics. And the ego, you got to get it out of the way. Everybody. Because the goal is there, as Gary's articulated so well. And so I would like to, I'm pleading with the other council members and yourselves to try to, whatever has caused this animosity, or this posture by whoever's I'm not gonna name names. I don't know enough about the backstory. But I won't be afraid if I learn the backstory to have conversations with any and all of them. And I think you all know that I'm not. I like to converse and try to move things forward, hopefully in private. But this potentially has the chance to go way beyond that for a lot of citizens. And I'll leave it at that with a plea for everyone. To put this aside, if there is a need for an urgency ordinance, it should be urgent. It should be urgent to the entire public, so the fact that the ordinance is public, so it can be scrutinized, possibly improved. There's a lot of good ideas in these things. They don't reside in a closed society of one particular group that doesn't conduct open meetings, that doesn't deliberate in public, but brings forth things that will change people's lifestyles and livelihoods. So I'd like to see that essentially end. Let's have a more public open debate when we have these disciplines. And Susan, I do have, I may have been previous to your time, but I've sat there and had many discussions, and we've had the pressures related to the Brown Act. I can recall being advised any number of times about serial meetings, which you may want to, maybe you could explain that to the general public. And also the fact that if I were to request a meeting, I request, as a commissioner, I would request that we bring subjects to the attention of all the members. That I communicate that through either the secretary or the planning director or some senior member of staff. Rather than create a circumstance, even by appearance, that I have discussed this situation and have essentially created a situation where you have a majority of our body that at least appear to have the consensus. Even by calling a meeting, they can appear to the public that there's a consensus involved. And I'd like to hear about that, kind of dissuade me if I'm wrong.
As I stated before, Government Code Section 54956 talks about the circumstances under which a special meeting may be called. And a special meeting may be called by a majority of the members of the legislative body. So in some ways, that is counterintuitive to the whole notion of a serial meeting, where a serial meeting occurs where you try to develop a collective understanding or agreement on a subject matter outside of a normal agendized meeting through whatever means. It could be email, telephone calls, smoke signals, doesn't matter. You're trying to develop that collective concurrence. Here, where the Brown Act itself says that a majority of the legislative body can ask for a special meeting, seems to create at least an exception in some ways to the otherwise rule that you can't have a serial meeting.
I would like to see a copy of actually how it's written. Even though it's not a formal meeting, I suppose there'll be a formal recording of this. You know, it's going to be a public document related to this proceeding. Is that correct?
No.
Well, how about the letter that's from the other three council members?
That's a public document.
Okay, I'm not certain of this, but because I don't have the document in front of me, but I think I heard sitting back here that there were expressions of opinion made in that letter, not a request only for a special meeting. And the fact that there's opinions expressed in that letter, rather than a request for a meeting, or the request for the postponement of the meeting, or however it was worded, there's expression of opinion, it appears to me. I'll reserve judgment to other people can look at it as well. But it appears to me there's an expression of opinion, and to me, if that's the case, I agree with Mr. Lindsay, that we may have a prima facie case of violation. I haven't concluded that, but it looks to me like it's definitely a possibility. And thank you for the link, for giving me the link of time. As you can tell, those people who know me, I'm a little wobbly in the voice, and a little bit.
I appreciate how well you kept it together, Frank. I do know you.
Thank you.
My name is Fred Reed. And I totally don't care if Brown Act or Red Act, but that's not my.
Can you talk into the microphone?
Okay.
If you can, you're a little on the tall side there.
Actually, I'm normal size person.
Oh, yeah. I'm just the short person.
So there are a couple of routes that we're going to go here. One of the routes is, do we have the legal armaments to shut these houses down as life is necessary? My opinion is that the city needs to fund a separate outside attorney that does nothing but focus on not telling us how it can't be done, but telling us how it can be done. In my corporate experience, I've lived with legal staff that we call the sales protection staff, because their job was to say no to everything we brought forward, and they had very good reasons to say no. They were very reasonable about saying no. And it wasn't until we had someone come in and say, we're going to hire attorneys, that we're going to bring them on to this plan, and it's going to say, you tell me how we legally do what we want to do. You're not here to say yes and no. That's not your job. The yes and no comes from you guys sitting up here. You're the ones that say, this is where we're going forward. A legal staff, don't open your mouth once to tell me how it can't be done, because I don't want to hear it. Tell me how it can be done. Because as she said very clearly, this is America. We can figure out how to get this thing done. That's one piece of it. I'd like to see the council do that, fund a separate outside attorney. The other piece of it is, and we were kind of going in a little bit with some of the earlier discussions, if in fact these are state laws that really don't care who owns them, and I suspect that might be this, then we need to have a separate advocate that plans and moves forward with identifying who the people at DSS are that made this specific decision for this place. And also, also who the state legislators are at the right committees, and assemble however many people we need to assemble, and I have a feeling that this group here could get several thousand people if we got to move, and get them down to Capitol and make this really ugly and root it out. Because television cameras like that, that's just where things happen. It can be well thought out, it can be reasoned, we can all be smiling when we get down there, and hide the torches and hand grenades and all that other stuff. But if you need to get that kind of critical mass of people moving towards the state. So I would like to have those two things happen. One, I'd like to see that the city come forward with funding an outside attorney who doesn't have any legal connections to the city, doesn't have any game playing with Brown, Green, Fred, whoever, what the heck it is we're doing internally, and can clearly focus on a specific mandate that says, you tell us how you shut these doors. If all of these houses have to have a green doorknob, then elicit a $5 million tax on every house with a green doorknob. Whatever it is that, you know, whatever it is that that's supposed to look like. And then on the other side of it, put together a very clear game plan that says very methodically, these are the people at the state legislature that hold the strings of the committees that push these laws. And this is the unit of DSS that put those goddamn houses in our home. We need to address both of those. So in the efforts of moving that one step further down the road, I'd like to see those things before.
Thank you.
If I may, I think you two together strike me as a pretty awesome team, because I think you're exactly right that the rally at the Capitol will do miles for exposure and make some people who might be feeling a little squirmy in their seats right now a little squirmier. And especially if you do it pointed, like you say, and find out which committees oversee ESS or whatever agencies have determined this regulation. Because part of, I think, the reason that the law is written the way that it is, and the city attorney and I were discussing this earlier, is that nobody wants these in their backyard, so the fix is, well, we'll just make it so there is no regulation, so everybody can have them in their backyard. But I think that there's two issues with this particular one. One is how this house is allowed to be there in the first place. The second is what I'm deeming to be a negligent operator in this Matheot Homes. We've had issues with them before, and as I understand it, they make something like $7,900 a month
per
individual in this house. That is a grip load of cash that this company is pulling in to destroy a neighbor.
Almost sick. $4 million.
It's sick. Which is in the route of maybe getting remuneration. If we do have to fund some expense to go after this, we can maybe get some remuneration on the back end. But my question would be, is since that this is, boils down to what I see as an issue between local control and centralized health, never such a large government, that the state is dictating this all decisions. Is this an issue that the League of California Cities has ever taken up, would take up? Or do they have a legal department or a specific legal foundation or someone else that does these things more or less pro bono that would be realizing that this is about quality of life, it's about property rights, because your property rights are being devalued, and that's exactly the thing that the Pacific League Foundation takes up. By a governmental decision that's arbitrary without respect for your rights. So I think you're on the right track. I made some notes here, but I think that we do need to get away from the no and what we can do, focus on what we can do, but there's no reason that we should put all of that on our shoulders or on our collective shoulders when there are other organizations that maybe in numbers it becomes easier to have.
Yes, the League of Cities has taken this issue up previously. In specific, Newport Beach led the charge along with various other than California cities signing on. And in Newport Beach, the issue was adult treatment for drug and alcohol. But again, unless it's a critical mass of voters and residents, the state legislature is in control. The League has a very small legal staff. There's also the Institute for Local Government that's an offshoot of the League. City attorneys, trust me, bang their heads against this issue all the time. I've been doing this for 15 years. It's been an issue for me for the entire time I've been a city attorney, and even before that, because the rules in play really do hamstring us. And that's why when I was talking to Councilor Hume for the meeting, I was trying to think we need to define exactly what the outcomes are that we want. And so I been listening very closely to this as to what outcomes we want. And there are some ways to do it and some ways not to do it. But ultimately, as I described at the last city council meeting, I provide you with legal advice, I give you a risk assessment, and it's up to them, the majority of the five of you, to decide if the juice is worth the squeeze.
Well, on that, in that note, just in that comment right there, four different times, you told us how to do that, she said.
So my question
with the process is, I need somebody that can say, how did San Diego go forward? How were these successes made? Because frankly, when we're sitting back in the back and listening to what can't be done, that is the most disarming thing that we can come across. And so what I'd like to see, and that was, you have your arms full of what to do with the city. I got that. But what we need is, we need someone that clearly gets that their own mission to figure out how to make it happen, not how to make it not happen.
I am not trying to make something happen or not make something happen.
But we have somebody that is.
Let me finish, please. We've not had any of the discussion that staff was ready to have to set some of this up, to discuss what the terms of the San Diego ordinance do and do not do, and whether that addresses the problems that this community is trying to solve for. Unless we know what we're trying to achieve, I can't tell you how to get there. You're saying that you want to have an outside attorney tell you how to get there. I'm still trying to figure out where you want to end up.
Get the house out of my neighborhood.
So with that being said, what about this idea? Because I think that part of the problem is when you shoot for the full Monty all at once, it becomes convoluted, complicated. People don't trust it. They wonder what's hidden in it. So maybe, I think, Carrie, you mentioned the first thing being that the juveniles should be registered just like adults. Maybe that's the first tangible step. Now, okay, we have something to work on. Okay, does this house meet that 2,000 foot? So I wrote down that having the Megan's Law requirements apply to juveniles. Okay, maybe that's the first thing we go after. And then...
And no grandfathering anybody
right,
in.
Right. So I think you're frustrated with the city attorney who's expressing her frustration and saying this is nothing new. People try to attack us. And I think she's right that because this is a broad issue, because it's a statewide issue, it becomes very easy for legislators to just sweep it under the rug and keep it as is and keep moving forward and the cogs of bureaucracy continue to move on. But maybe if there's specific things that can be very high profile, can be very tangible, that we can do those in increments. The end goal is have it so that these houses no longer get shoved down our throats, but how we get there maybe is not working.
So the first thing we need then, if I'm understanding, is a mission statement, right? A definition of what it is we're trying to complete.
What I've heard several different goals this evening, each of which are achievable to some degree or other, but many of them are not going to be achievable in this council chambers. This is not the place, for example, to change Megan's Law. We don't have the ability to amend Penal Code Section 290, which creates the registration system. We don't have the ability to amend the United States Constitution that precludes us from not grandfathering or grandfathering folks in because of the ex post facto clause that precludes us from creating new criminal penalties for acts already done.
I think the ex post facto clause.
I hate it almost as much as the Dormant Commerce Clause, and you and I can talk about that later.
What about the Walsh Act?
I'm sorry?
So what you're describing is the second option that I described, or the second way of this thing heading towards the legislature.
If you want to have juvenile registrants have the same requirements as adults, right now juveniles do. So, for example, when we're looking at Penal Code Section 3003.5, which is the penal code section that the San Diego ordinance takes and modifies, when you look at that and it talks about the 2,000-foot restriction for sexual registrants, it applies to any person. That means adult or juvenile.
Yeah.
It's any person. So the problem, though, is that what juveniles have, if you are a juvenile sex offender, the class of offenses for which you become a registrant is far different from the class of offenses that you have to perform in order to be an adult registrant. So, for example, as an adult, if you commit the crime of indecent exposure, you will become a sex registrant. You become a 290 registrant. If you're a juvenile and commit that crime the way the law is currently written, you are not a registrant.
So we don't know if these guys have to be registered or not?
The police chief will answer.
So, I mean, that's why I say, that's why I've been trying to get my mind around exactly what we want to have happen. And when we all last met on the 14th, the discussion at the podium and at the dais was about regulating the homes. What the ordinance that's presented does is regulate the individuals, exclusive of the homes. So there are different, that's why I keep saying, what is it that we're trying to accomplish? Because if you try to regulate group homes, we're not riding on a clean slate. And we have limited abilities to do much of anything. If you want to start trying to regulate the residency of registrants, the law does give us the ability to do that in 3003.5 of the Penal Code. So it just depends on what we're trying to do. I can't guarantee you as we sit here today that I'm ever going to be, I or any other lawyer, is going to be able to tell you how to get rid of a home in your neighborhood. DSS can pull their license, but again, that's not in this chambers.
Yes.
That's with DSS. So that's why these different layers of government matter and why it gets frustrating for the average resident, because they don't care. They just look at it as, the problem needs to be fixed.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Okay, you're very welcome. Let's have our police chief make some comments, give added information.
Thank you, Mayor Sherman, Council Member Hume, city staff, and members of the public. As I think some of you know, I wasn't here for the council meeting, but I do want to let you know that I did listen to it live when it was happening, and I've since listened to portions of that tape twice just to make sure I understood some of the underlying issues. The first thing I want to say is the folks that have talked about all of the research that you've done, I'm sure you saw in all of that research that Elk Grove's not alone. And not only is Elk Grove not alone, California's not alone. The issues you're describing, you will see over and over and over again in every state in the United States. In fact, it is the resulting activity on the part of many legislatures that Bingham's Law is now a law in some form in every single one of the 50 states. Every one of the communities I've lived in and worked in, we have wrestled with some of these issues. What I do hope to do today in these brief comments is to provide some framework around what I heard and put it in kind of three different contexts. The first is, as your police department, what we have done, are doing, and can do now to address some of the issues that were brought up. Then I'm going to transition a little bit into sex offender registration and talk briefly about our ordinance, the registration requirements for state law, and the San Diego law, for example, and then I'll defer the rest of that conversation to the city attorney. The last thing I want to do is something that keeps getting hit around in the conversation, and it is a critical piece. I will highlight it again when I get to it. There is a huge gap in this discussion, and it's that gap that permits houses like this to operate and to land in neighborhoods like this and cause these problems all over the country, although we'll regionalize it to California and Elk Grove because there are some laws specific to that. But that's something I'm going to want everybody hopefully to pay real close attention to, because if we're going to get at this problem, that's the gap that we're going to need to address. So first, what have we done? What are we doing? What can we do? The police department has, in fact, been called to that home. I won't say the call load there is heavy, but we do have a call load there. We have a call load to the other group homes in Elk Grove as well. There are a total of 9 of them. And with respect to this home and its activities there, it's certainly a concern. I would not call it presently a resource drain. In the past, it has been a problem-oriented policing unit project, a POP project. And as a result of this incident, we have again assigned that to our POP unit. And what that means is they will begin making contacts with the neighbors, hopefully giving you information about who to call when you see things that are suspicious or things are going on that don't quite rise to the level of a 911 or even a non-emergency call, that we can start monitoring and doing something about. In most cases, that's going to be primarily just some additional appearance, but I think that will be helpful in this neighborhood. You'll see, hopefully, officers more often as they're available to monitor the situation. One of the things we're going to have them look at is whether or not we can play a role in monitoring the licensing and activities of the business that operates this facility. Obviously, it's a little outside of the box, but that's what POP units are all about. And we're going to have some pretty significant conversations with the state agencies responsible. But I want to know a couple of things. Number one, can we, the City of Elk Grove Police Department, or any one individual, file a specific complaint that then requires an inspection and action? And what ability do we have to do that? What grounds do we need to do that? What rights do we have to receive information on the follow-up of that in terms of what was found? My guess is that with the reductions in budgets over the last few years, that they are probably pretty stretched. And while there are limitations, I'm sure, to their ability to monitor all of these different facilities all over the region, what I want to know is what we can do. What does it take to push that up on the priority list, and what can we do to cause a regulatory inspection of some kind? The next is sort of a related question, and I already know the answer with respect to probation, but I do not know the answer with respect to certain licensing. One of the benefits that derives from a general peace officer certification under POST is it gives us the authority to enforce all manner of law, including some that may fall under other regulatory authorities. What I'm going to ask, or have asked, of DSS or whomever else it is there a way that we can perform, the Elk Grove Police can perform, be trained to and perform some of those inspections ourselves? Can we bring some of those licensing violations ourselves, or at least cause them to be brought by our monitoring? As we sit here today, I don't know the answer to that question, but we're going to find out the answer to that question. I think it's going to be complex because I think there are going to be multiple agencies involved, but that's something that we are going to do. No special action is going to be required to do that. Pardon? My boss says it's been done, so to some degree, I'm sure we'll be able to do it.
No, I started that conversation this afternoon with DSS. Thank
you. Transitioning a little bit into sex offender registration. The current city code does have some of the provisions of the San Diego ordinance that was recently offered as a good example. Other cities have them as well. Ours is fairly comprehensive, but it's certainly not what I would call complete in the sense that it doesn't have all of the elements of all of the different various codes and ordinances that would make it call it as tight as possibly can be made under existing law. I'm going to let Susan talk about the differences a little bit about what we do have, what the San Diego ordinance has that ours doesn't, that might be possible. And I don't know if she's been able to look much farther than that yet, but that's something we need to do in terms of regulating where sex offenders can live, the distance requirements, and those kinds of things. One of the challenges that we're going to have is this issue of who is required to register and not. In that regard, I did have our detectives that do this work in Elk Grove. By the way, we have one of the most, call it aggressive, monitoring programs anywhere in the state. We are one of the few agencies in the state, for example, that can claim that 100% of our registered sex offenders, those that appear on the Megan's List and those that don't quite meet that criteria but are still required to register, 100% of those people have been forced to give the required DNA samples under law. Many other cities don't have that, and I realize that raises other issues, but my point is that we're pretty aggressive about monitoring and enforcing our registrants. I also had him run these, all of the group homes, not just this one. And there are no registered sex offenders, and that's not just Megan's Law registrants, that's those that even meet the lower criteria, in other words, who are required to register in any form of law, presently known to reside in any one of those residences. Here's what that means. It means either the person or the business is going to end up being in violation of some requirement to notify because they have such a person. That's one possibility. The other, and I think it's more likely from what we've seen, is that the people presently in residence there are not required to register. That's what I'm about to talk about in terms of the big gap that we have to stay focused on. There is a large group of people, including probably all, many if not all, of the current residents of that facility who do not meet the legal requirement to register at all. I need to say that again. They're not required to register at all. Here's why that's important. We can work as hard as we want. We can get all kinds of changes we want. You could pass, well, you could pass, it wouldn't be upheld, but you could pass something that says no registered sex offender can live in the city of Elk Grove, and if it were to pass legal muster, those people would still live in the city of Elk Grove. And those are the people that are causing the issues that are being talked about here. I do think that that's a place ripe with opportunity, where the right group of elected officials, police officials, city staff, citizenry, to get together and make a difference.
Can you please turn off your cell phones?
Can get together and make a difference. And this is also where, piggybacking on what Susan said earlier, other cities have struggled with this issue as well. We're not alone. We don't need to be alone in this. But Councilmember Hume, you talked about a narrow focus. Actually, while I partially agree with you, I think you have to hit all of these pieces in order to make this successful. But one focus that we all have to have that we cannot lose is the fact that we're dealing with this gap of people who are not required to register. Whether the answer is increasing by legislation the types and numbers of people that are required to register, for example, juveniles convicted of lower level of offenses. Juveniles, in fact, don't have to register if they've never been in custody of the Department of Corrections. That's different than adults, and that makes a big difference in cases like this. Whether it's some form of regulatory ability over persons with dangerous conditions, be they medical or mental. I'm thinking out loud now, but my point is we've got to be able to get at that particular group. And Susan said one other thing that I have to underscore. While I think we can all be involved, and I think it's important from a policy perspective, the city says it is a policy that we're trying to make this city a safe place to live, including these areas, I do think we need to recognize where the right forum is to cause those things to happen, because if we don't, then we're just going to spin our wheels. So that's kind of framing it. I can answer some other questions. One thing I would like Susan to talk about is the existing ordinance, the registration requirements, but let's not lose the fact that there are a whole bunch of people out there who aren't required to register.
So if I can just ask a couple of questions. And I think you were touching on what I was suggesting, is that the narrow focus is that we have to do things incrementally towards that end goal, because if we were to go straight toward having the 2,000-foot requirement upheld or strengthened, and we hadn't done that first step of addressing that gap of who has to register, we've now missed an important component.
Well, I think we need to do both, but the issue is there's been so much energy around getting some improved restrictions regarding where sex offenders can be.
Right.
And I think that's important. But assuming we succeed in that, that's the easy part of this battle. And we need not to pat ourselves on the back too quickly. We need to recognize that the bigger part of that battle is yet to come.
And so then the folks living in this house that are not required to register, is that because of the nature of their offense? Is that because of the age of the individual? Is that an arbitrary decision by DSS that, hey, this person is rehabilitable or
assuming that they're not outright acting illegally, and I have to tell you, I don't believe they are, the answer is the first two things that you said, that it is the nature of the offense, which for juveniles is different than for adults, and the time of registration is different for juveniles than it is for adults. And the fact that in many cases, juveniles don't have to register at all. And an issue came up yesterday, I have absolutely no information on, but we're going to find out. I think that people can end up in there for treatment for some very serious, similar situations that have never been arrested. Ever. That's not somebody that's ever going to end up being required to register.
Chief, when they're placed in these homes, and I don't know how much, I'm sure you know quite a bit about it, more than most of us, but when they're placed in these homes and they're evaluated, I guess, like a better word, do they see that the evaluation goes along with the rest I don't call them inmates, but the rest of the residents of that home, are they equal? Or are there some high, some low? That some could be, like we were reading Save Our Children, Help Our Children.
I think it depends on the particular group home and that particular operation. I'm reasonably certain that it would be, if not against the law, certainly against some significant health regulations to mix adults and juveniles, for example. Whether or not there's a distinction between the level of severity of offender that can be in the same group home, I don't know.
Well, is it something that we can use as part of our searching here so that we're all on the same page? Because I think it's real important that we don't have someone that, like that young man that got arrested the other day that was committing those deaths, and reading that, you know, looking at his history, he had no business being in that home, because I don't know the rest of the residents there, but it's hard to believe that the rest of them are as high risk as that.
Well, I have to be very careful how I say what I'm going to say next, but I did look at that particular case because I remember when it happened. And in light of this discussion, I went back and I wanted to look at the circumstances in a little more detail to see how a person like that could be not required to be registered. And in fact, because of his background and everything else, it wasn't even a gray area or a close call. He was clearly not, he did not meet a registration criteria. He wasn't a required registrant.
Really?
So there's a good example of somebody who by the registration or requirement alone, you would never be able to place at that level of risk. How we do that, I don't know. I'm not saying we can't. I'm just saying I don't have the answer to that yet.
Right. Something that we need to look at into as well. There's so many parts and pieces to this. And like we said before, Carrie, sure, come on up.
I just have one quick question. So going back to, you were talking about having to register and so forth. What law, is that just the city law or a state law, or are you going by the Walsh Act that was signed in 2006? Because I thought that that law changed the laws on how juveniles were supposed to register. And it was up to the city or the governing body to apply those restrictions.
Right. Actually, what I'm going by is the Juvenile Code. And okay. what it says is here are the conditions that trigger a registration requirement. Okay. And they are different for juveniles and for adults. And that's contained in state law. The registering authority is the police agency head of the jurisdiction. Ultimately, that's me and my department. We have an active investigative component that we monitor these people. When we believe we have somebody living in the jurisdiction that's required to register and that doesn't, we take aggressive and immediate action to correct that. The gist of your question, though, is should he have been required to register under California law? And again, without getting into the detail of a juvenile that I can't do, I can tell you I looked at that, and he did not fit any criteria. Here's what I want to add, though, that's pretty scary. Even with the current offense, he would not be required to register.
Right, and I fully understand that. Some of the cases that I have been reading, you may have read one of them on our website. If you're committing sodomy and rape, does that quantify?
That would be a registrable offense. And all I'm saying is, based on today's look at the people residing in the group homes in Elk Grove, either someone is in there illegally and we don't know it, or there is no one in there presently that meets that registration requirement.
So, I mean, I don't know. My readings have told me, or, you know, what I've been doing research about the Walsh Act, that California has not adopted that. I don't know if that's something that you can adopt as a city, since you're an individual governing body, but why it was enacted and nobody's following up on it, I don't understand why nobody's following a federal law.
I'm going to have to defer to the city attorney because I'm not sure. But what happens when Megan's Law, Adam's Law, all of those other kinds of things come into being, there's usually an enabling state legislation that then mirrors all or most of that. Local police departments, with very rare exception, cannot enforce a federal law. And in a case like those, usually what you have is the Congress will pass something that says, by one mechanism or another, we're going to force all states to pass these laws. So that we, as the police, act based on a state law or regulation, not on the basis of a federal law. What components of that made it or didn't make it into California law, I don't know, but the standards that I was referring to are right out of the current Penal Code. Susan, do you know the answer to that?
I'm looking at the Adam Walsh Act that was signed into law in 2006. So you're talking about is a federal statute that provides funding and does several other things. So I will tell you that California has had a sexual registered law on the books since 1944. And that's Penal Code Section 290. So when we talk about 290 registers, that's what we're talking about. As I'm looking through what the U.S. Code says, it deals much more with persons convicted in federal courts and with criminal law and procedure, and I'm not seeing where it gives local jurisdictions the ability to do anything.
Well, maybe, I just wanted to bring that to your attention, maybe if you could research it more.
Yeah.
And find out if maybe that's something that we can, you know, maybe move forward on.
Thank you, Karen.
Sophia, I had a question too for the chief, can I?
Sure.
This is trying to track to where we want to go with this, chief, is that we knew there was laws, and we weren't sure and clear on what was happening in the house. So you said a lot of things that I'm sure encouraged the folks on your court that can be done. But the thing that we're looking for, Susan asked about where do we want to go with this, is the policing of it. And we know that there's other regulations that have to be dealt with, probation department or CPS, DPS, all those other entities, but I think we can start from policing. And the biggest thing is that you hit on something that was about how we've done our investigation to see what's in there now and in the different homes. Our argument is, has always been, we figured that, because there's been a lot of cleanup work done in the last 3 days and since the other day by this home. But what we're suggesting is that if they were unethical prior to that, or they had people living in that home who weren't registrable, then they're moving folks around. And if that happened, if they registered them in the county when they were living in one of the other county areas, and then moved them to us, and then figure out, oops, we got some stuff going on, and move them again, we know that's a law violation. But we think that based on the information that we've received, is that there's a lot of moving around the folks. We're suggesting no proof whatsoever. But until we can get an investigative unit in there, social services provided them with the license, and they're the ones who's conducting this mock investigation on if there's any violations there. Now, I don't even know if we have the ability to do that or if there's a governing body that can, but that's why I'm saying we reach for the law, because I think there's someone who can investigate what they've done, not since June 28th, since they've done since the year 2000, because that's where we think we've had these violations that have gone unchecked, because most of the citizens were complaining to NAPIA, not our police department, or not even our city government. So the scary part is that we know that we have a very good feeling that there's violations going on in there, but they've cleaned them up now. So we're not just going to look at what we saw in our investigation the last couple of weeks, but what was happening prior to that in our city. And the players may not even have been in place, or the chief, and whatever the case may be, but I'm frustrated that we're not looking further back, because that's where we're going to find the violation. And whoever that investigative body that can do that, and I don't know if it's our police, our attorney, or their license, they're set to bring in another entity to do that.
Dallas, at the last meeting, you brought up the subject about at 11 o'clock, they all pile in the van and the van takes off. Have you any more information on that?
There's a lot of miscommunication on that. Actually, when Kevin was speaking to that, he lost his train of thought. My opinion of it, and I'm kidding about it, but I think he was getting really pissed and that he got off track. But what he was saying, and this happened the other night when they were in their court, these kids leave there anywhere from 9 o'clock to 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, they're traveling with supposedly the supervision, but where are these kids
are they going?
Yeah. And I don't know if that's any of our business or not, but based on what they claim is in there, what their website says is in there, it's scary. Understand completely about the registration. Understand completely about the laws and changing that is so far down the road, it's scary. But the issue of if there was violations prior to June 28th, that's where I think we can get at. Not only at your court, but at the other houses that we're aware of. But we're trying to close it down based on our law, our city law, our penal code law. That's how I think we can get the step on it. But
and I think from just kind of a layman unfortunately not knowing too much about all of this. That, the chief was speaking to something that I had asked Captain Noble at the last meeting, that every time we get a complaint, do we have the right to go in there and inspect that house? And I think the chief is saying that working with DSS, have them trained so that our PD can act as DSS inspectors. Is one thing we can do. We also have a building and code enforcement department. Have they made any modifications to the house and not applied for the proper building permits? These are things that we as a city are entitled to do. But I think to go, we can only operate off of existing conditions and controls. To go backward, I think, is where it's going to have to go through DSS or some other agency.
If I may add to that, Dallas, if I may add to Councilmember Hume's comment, we also have the fire department, and if it's a group home, they need to go in and make sure that it's, you know, fire, all fire codes are met. So would that be a possibility to have our fire department go in along with our PD to do an inspection?
Just as when we go into any place, residence, business, doesn't matter, we have to have certain legal requirements or we have to be granted permission. Fire is the same way. What I did want to do, though, is talk about the retroactivity here a little bit, because there are two things I think we need to look for. Both the licensing and regulatory issues associated with the license, and that's where we either have to find a mechanism to cause the right people to be able to do that, or we have to find out if there's any possible way that we legally can do it. But if there were violations that amount to penal code violations that are not outside a prosecutable statute of limitations, we can and will charge them.
Can I interview?
Yes, sir.
I live next door. I'm right next door to the people in the court. And I was part of the first intervention where we came to the city council. We also had a town hall meeting at Oak Grove High School in regards to this. And one of the questions that I brought forward was the criteria for the licensing. The state board was there. They were represented. City council was represented. We had the senator. They were represented at that point. Nobody knew the real criteria for this level of a residential home. So my understanding is, hearing this today, if we're going to take the elderly and we're going to take the needy in, are they looking at doorknobs to make sure that they're secure and to make sure that they have locks on them? Or is there an actual criteria for the level of residence that they're enforcing? Is there supposed to be a certain level of people? Are there supposed to be doctor records? Are there supposed to be for this that goes on? Secondly, I just want to make this quick because I know you guys are.
No problem.
We did write the state. We had problems in the neighborhood. We wrote a list of things to the social service department. They sent an investigator to our house. And part of the things that we were seeing their residents sitting on top of a roof looking at girls in bathing suits. We had to go to the next door neighbor, to the house, and say, do you know where your kids are? And no, they didn't know. So we called social services out after so much had gone on. They were throwing cigarettes in our bushes. I mean, they had to come out at night. They were watching me go to the bathroom through my window. We couldn't prove anything. So what we did do is we wrote a letter to the social service department, the licensing board, and they sent an investigator out. The state sent an investigator out. Well, if you want to know who responded, who we got our response from, Mathiot was the one that responded to the state investigation. Everything that we complained about, and I'll drop this off with you if you want. But the state sat in our front room and they said, Mr. Prey, Mrs. Prey, you know what, we agree 100% with you. They should be doing this.
They have six kids in a house that is possibly 1,800 square feet. The backyard for these kids to be, for them to have things to do in this house, the backyard is smaller than the house itself. I mean, they can't even go out and put a swing set back there for six teenagers that have access to five homes on the backside of their fence. I mean, what is the criteria? They know that these are violent kids. The office is saying, yeah, well, we have had our hearts. We've seen the cars. We've seen the red lights. Our kids are suffering. We did complain. We did go through the right services to get this done. Matthew sends a letter out that says, F you, Mr. Craig.
Sounds like lip service to me.
Yeah.
Well, it was county, not the state.
And the county, I'm sorry. Yeah, it was the county.
Yeah.
Oh.
But they just...
No, I'm talking about the owner of the property.
Yeah. Seeing that everything that you complained about never happened.
Never what happened. I'll.
Thank you. That leads into our city manager. We've got to give us an update, which we've been working on for the last 2 days or so.
I was fortunate enough to find a contact at the Department of Social Services who, you know, basically confirmed everything you all have told us, that that they received a complaint on July the 1st. Investigators went out on July 9th and July 16th. Matthew has been given a citation. Your complaints were sustained. There has been a correction plan that's been developed, and by what you have just said about a lot of work being done over the last 3 days, it's probably because State Department of Social Services has told them what improvements need to be made, and they also noted that supervision was not up to par, and there is a correction plan for that. And it is on their radar screen and will be following up. So that's what I have for you as far as an update. So everything that you have said, they know it. It's on the radar screen and they're monitoring. However, we need to go a little bit further, and I'm having those conversations with the regional manager and the program administrator now, and hopefully we'll be able to give you more of an update on that over the next couple of days. Unfortunately, she and I have played phone tag this afternoon. Yes, ma'am.
Is there any way that you can find out, you know, how many violations or what type
Mary,
of
can you come up to the
Whatever you want me to follow up with DSS,
yes.
I am glad to do it.
Okay, so how many violations does it constitute, or what types of violations constitute a removal of a license?
Mm-hmm.
Because in my opinion, when that court case was settled 2 years ago and they were in clear violation and not providing proper supervision and allowing that juvenile to have sexual relations with 10, and let's just assume they only have sex with them one time each, which we all know is not true. How are they still doing business? That's what I don't understand. Why is the county not revoking their license?
Because it's not, I don't think it's the county providing the license. I think it's the state.
Okay.
Well, then how is the state
not?
But I got to go follow up on the state's procedure.
On their website, it says, at the bottom of their website, it says specifically, licensed by social services.
It does say state.
No, that was a question. I don't know if it does say state.
It is.
Get that, Susan, that's my answer.
It's a state.